God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things.
Some of the popes through the years have made some pretty astonishing prophecies. Were they just chattering, thinking no one alive then would know if they were right or wrong? Or did they receive divine knowledge? To discuss the providential aspect is Pastor Larry with Tom Horn and Chris Putnam.
It's so good to be with you today. There is a new book out from Defender Publishing. It is authored by Tom Horn and Chris Putnam. They have written three international bestsellers, Petrus Romanus, Exo Vaticana, and also On the Path of the Immortals. They have just completed a fourth, and the full title, we're going to be talking in particular about that, The Final Roman Emperor, the Islamic Antichrist, and the Vatican's Last Crusade. That's all one title in one book, and it's got some 414 pages with 751 endnotes. We're going to tell you how to get that book, as well as getting the previous three if you don't have them. This is their last writing project of a four-year investigation, and friends, let me tell you this. No library on the end times can be considered complete unless it has a copy of The Final Roman Emperor and the preceding three as well. Tom and Chris, it's so good to have you on our show.
Hey, great to be on with you, Larry.
Hey, Larry. Pleasure to be back.
Wonderful. Well, you know, gentlemen, there may be some in our listening audience, and I do know that we have picked up a lot of new listeners who may not be familiar with your previous volumes, and they really stick together, and I think to understand this last one, you have to know about the first three. So tell us where you've been going with these massive studies, what you found, and what does it mean for us today in what is probably the 11th hour of human history?
Well, if I can, Larry, I'll jump in and get us going, and then I'll let Chris jump in, too. I'm glad you asked us to kind of, you know, synopsize the first three books. And this fourth one is the final one in this four-year series. I can tell you that Chris and I never set out to write four books. You know, we just, but there's been a lot of supernatural events. I think Chris would even tell you that this entire four-year investigation has had a very strange, almost kind of preternatural feel to it. That started back about 4 years ago. I was one of the keynote speakers at Chuck Misler's Strategic Perspectives Conference in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I happened to be standing in the back waiting for my turn to speak, you know, and was talking to my son, Joe Artis. And the conversation came up how it was unusual that the 900-year-old, allegedly 900-year-old, Prophecy of the Popes, which is a really famous prophecy within Catholic circles that was ascribed to an Irish bishop by the name of Malachi Morgair, who was an Irish bishop during the 1100s, and who allegedly had a vision in Rome in which he saw every pope that would exist from that time until the final one. And he wrote them all down, a series of Latin verses, 112 verses depicting each of these popes in their order. Well, Pope Benedict was the next to the last one. He was Pope number 111. And so here I am standing there, I think this was 2010 or 2011, talking to my son, saying, isn't it weird that you have this prophecy, and whether you believe that it was divinely inspired or a fraud or maybe even demonically inspired, it was certainly a prophecy that a lot of Catholics, including Catholic popes, had ascribed to, had gave credence to, even had lived their lives in such a way as to show themselves as a fulfillment of their line in this prophecy. So we knew that they gave it a lot of credit. But if for no other reason than historical value, we wondered why nobody had written a really thorough examination of the prophecy of the popes, given the fact that whoever took Benedict's place would be the final one on this list, Pope number 112, who the writer of the prophecy called Petrus Romanus. That's why the title of that first book is Petrus Romanus, the final pope, is here. Well, anyway, make a long story short, I decided that after talking with Joe, I should consider whether or not, being the owner of a publishing house, we should publish a book on this. And so I went up to my room before I spoke at Coeur d'Alene to send myself an email with some notes that we had written down during that conversation. And I go up to my bedroom and open my computer, log into my account, and lo and behold, I've got an email sitting in there from a guy by the name of Chris Putnam. Now, Chris and I, we vaguely knew each other. We had exchanged a couple of emails, but we had never met face-to-face. We had certainly never worked on, you know, co-authoring a book project before. And so I open his email, and here's what he says. He says, "Tom, I want to talk to you about the prophecy of the popes and doing some work together on it," or something like that. So I emailed him back, and I said, "Chris, you can't believe the timing of this email. And I won't give these to you blow by blow, but the bottom line was that was the first in a whole series of very strange incidents that convinced Chris and I that something was really up. We decided to write the book, and of course it became an international bestseller, and the main reason that it did was because on about page 450, I'm not exactly sure of the page, but around 450 in the book Petrus Romanus, Chris and I made the argument that we believed it was likely that Pope Benedict was going to step down from the Petrine office, that unlike 600 years of popes before him who died in office, he was going to abdicate the throne. We said he's going to cite health reasons for doing so. And we furthermore, we said, we believe that's going to happen around April of 2012. And so Chris and I were out there a year before Benedict stepped down, talking about this on television, a lot of different television shows. We were on your program. We published the book, which came out before the resignation. And then when April of 2012 came and went, and it did not appear that Benedict was going to step down, we thought, well, okay, we missed the date, but we still believe it's going to happen. But then, February 28th, 2013, the Vatican announces that Pope Benedict has stepped down, has retired essentially, is going to become Pope Emeritus there at the Vatican. And the same day, the El Observatorio Romano, which is the Vatican's owned news authority, they gave an interview to the New York Times. And in that interview, which people can still Google and read, they admitted that Pope Benedict had actually officially retired at the end of a March trip, 2012, and in April of 2012, it became quietly and secretly official with certain members of the Vatican Curia, their government, and they started remodeling a building that this Pope Emeritus would live in as they searched for the next Pope. And so when that happened, and people around the world knew that Chris and I had been out there talking about it and specifically naming April of 2012, I mean, our phones were on fire. People all over the world were wanting to know, okay, who was your secret insider at the Vatican, right? And we laughed and said if we told them that it was the Holy Spirit, that would have really confused them, right?
Well, that is amazing because now Pope Francis is Petrus Romanus, Peter the Roman, according to the Malachi prophecy, and you discussed that in this book, page 173. And I've been going through some of the stuff that you had written before. The Vatican's telescope on top of Mount Graham in Arizona. As you point out, Mount Graham is a portal to another dimension. It all sounds way off the wall, but the research that you guys have done just makes it so convincing. I just love that kind of stuff. You know, there are a lot of people that make these off-the-wall comments, and they've got no documentation. You guys have it, and with this prediction, the way it worked out, he really did resign in 2012, so this is phenomenal.
Well, and I'm going to let Chris jump in here, but why that led to this second book, Ex Vaticana, is because now we're out there. The History Channel wants Chris Putnam on, you know, one of their special editions. I turned down being on CNN and Fox News and different ones because I've just decided I'm only going to do Christian television. And there were people that wanted us to travel to Rome, we were warned not to do that, so we didn't do that. We, you know, get over there and get captured or something, right? But so what was happening, if you recall, this was during the VatiLeaks scandal, but it was also during the time that several of the Vatican's top astronomers were out there, and they started talking about how it's more likely than not that advanced extraterrestrial intelligence exists. They would be our space brothers. We would baptize them in the Catholic faith. And so when we're doing radio, me and Chris and TV talking about the resignation of the Pope and all that, wherever people could call in, they were calling in saying, yeah, but what do you make of the Vatican now talking about aliens? And we knew that to really get behind that story, we were going to have to try to do something that's nearly impossible, and that was to get to the top of Mount Graham in southeastern Arizona. And Chris can tell you that story, but that was what led then to Exo-Vaticana and that whole second part of the investigation.
Well, Tom, I before we let Chris explain a little bit more about that, I did want to add, you know, I'm sure I'm going to get some calls and I'm going to get some emails and some people are going to say, we'll never listen to Southwest Radio Church again, on and on. That happens from time to time. But friends, let me say this. I want to encourage you to, number one, to get the book, actually to get all four books, because there is so much there. Number two, I want to encourage you to be prayerful, okay, before you pick up the phone and tell me off kind of a thing. Just be very, very prayerful about it. And here's the next item, which I really think is important. Don't you realize that these are the last days? And hey, the Bible makes it very clear that in the last days, there are going to be some unusual supernatural phenomena taking place. I mean, we are in a spiritual battle. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. So all of this stuff that you're hearing from Tom and Chris, don't tell me these guys are way off and on and on and on. Just be open and realize that we are in tempestuous times. Just look at the paradigm changes that have happened in America. I mean, postmodernism is now being squared to the nth degree. The things that are going on now are far beyond human depravity. This has to be satanic, demonic, and devilish. Well, Chris, let's bring you in. I just did want to make that statement right before you come on in. So tell us about Arizona.
Well, Larry, Arizona was quite an interesting trip. We're really surprised by some of the things that we saw there. And I just want to go back and talk about a few of the things that Tom mentioned, and then I'll bring it right up to Arizona. You know, he mentioned that time when we wrote Petrus Romanus and we hardly knew each other and how things just kind of fell into our lap. And that's really the case. I just wanted to add a little bit to that. I mean, when we started that research, there really wasn't much scholarly work done on this prophecy of the popes, but I did find several sources from scholars at Oxford that, and one of them was a Muslim even, but he thought it was probably a genuine prophecy because he traced so many fulfillments that he couldn't explain away, you know, with naturalistic type explanations like coincidence. You know, for that reason, that's the only reason that I decided to take it somewhat seriously, because I'm really not a subscriber to Catholic prophecies. You know, even though you could probably find websites and people on the internet that would call me a Jesuit or something, if you read the book Petrus Romanus, I go to great lengths to falsify Catholic theology and talk about, you know, the Marian worship and all of the things that they do, and show how they're not consistent with the New Testament. So, you know, anyone out there calling me a Jesuit really has not read our work. I really challenge Catholic theology in quite a few profound ways, I believe. But this prophecy does seem to have something to it. There are some of the fulfillments that just can't be explained away. Religio depopulata was the one that coincided just dramatically with World War I and just all the events that religion was depopulated at that time. And that was the prophecy that fell specifically during the time of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, where you had churches destroyed and just millions of Christians basically forced to, you know, declare atheism by the communist government. And if they didn't, they were imprisoned. And so today we have ministries like Voice of the Martyrs. They're a result of that activity. But, you know, this prophecy nailed that time period in a quite incredible way. It said religion depopulated, you know, right at the time that it happened. So during that pope's reign, religion was depopulated. And see, the reason why that kind of prediction is so compelling to me is that it's falsifiable. And a lot of people, you know, in the scientific method, what they do is they create a hypothesis, and then they try to find ways to falsify it. Because it's easy to find confirmations for things if you're looking for them. But if you can think of a way to prove something false, and then you do that, and it doesn't prove false, then it doesn't prove the theory is true, but it suggests that it might be. And, it, you know, the more of those you can build up, the better, the more security you can have that you're dealing with something real. Now, you know, there's quite a few of those that seem to do that. Not all of them do, but enough of them do where it's compelling. So that's why we took it seriously. Now, you know, moving forward rapidly, you know, Tom mentioned lots of kind of preternatural things happen as we did this research, and I just want to confirm that and really add to it that this last book, The Final Roman Emperor, is Islamic Antichrist and the Vatican's Last Crusade. I've never experienced the level of spiritual warfare that I've experienced when I was working on this last book. I mean, it was incredible. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to finish it. I had 5 computers go down on me. I would have never got this book done if Tom hadn't helped me get a new Macintosh just in time, right at the deadline. And it's been a battle just to get it. And I don't know if the listeners know, but I've moved here to Crane, Missouri from North Carolina, and I'm now working full-time at the Skywatch studio, and I'll be developing a television program based on the book, The Supernatural Worldview, here. So it was also quite a battle to get here, but I'll save that story for another time. But I'm really glad to be here in Crane, and you know, it's going to be an adventure, I think. We're really starting something special here. You did ask me about Arizona, and I kind of dodged it a little bit to go back and cover that. So, yeah, Arizona is quite an amazing place. Now, when we first went to Mount Graham, that was the first time I'd ever been there. And that place alone is rather unusual, because we went Mount Graham. They call it a sky island ecosystem. So basically, you're in a really arid desert, nothing but tumbleweeds and cactuses. And then as you start to go up this mountain, you just see all this plush greenery, wildlife, ponds, you know, all kinds of plants that don't exist in the desert environment. And so this is why environmentalists are kind of upset that they're building up there. Of course, we also discovered after the fact that the Indians hold this as one of their most sacred mountains. And, you know, I sort of assumed it was because maybe they had burial grounds up there or some kind of, you know, rituals that they would do up there. Well, that's part of it, but Tom actually received an email from an Indian who told him, you know, you sort of got it, but you really missed the big point. And they actually believe that Mount Graham is a portal. And there are Indian legends about disc-shaped objects coming down and whatnot in that area. So we were kind of surprised to find that out. Now, we didn't know that when we first went. Interestingly, in the book, On the Path of the Immortals, which followed Exo Vaticana, I went back to Arizona, but this time I went to Sedona, because it's worldwide famous for being a portal area, an area that actually transfers things from other dimensions. And this is what most of the paranormal researchers will say, and a lot of the people, the New Agers, it's a really big New Age community there, a lot of what we would call pagan religion, I suppose. And it's really based on Eastern pantheistic monism, for the most part. All is one. You know, we're all becoming one. And, of course, that notion is easily falsified, I think, mainly by the problem of evil. Because if all is one, how do you explain good and evil? It really isn't coherent with what most of us instinctively know to be true, that there really are things that are evil. There's no time that I can think of where it's okay to torture children for fun. Okay, so if there's one thing that's truly evil, that means that absolute evil and good do exist. You know, the New Age idea that all is one is false. So that's a falsifiable proposition, and it's falsified. But so many people in our culture believe it to be true. As you said, Larry, it's really due to postmodernism, this idea that truth is relative. The idea of relativism is that, you know, you have your truth and I have mine, and, you know, whether we disagree or not doesn't really matter. It's true for you. Now, you know, that's obviously false when you're dealing with your finances. To get to people, you know, if I steal your wallet, you're going to tell me that's absolutely wrong. And, you know, if there's one absolute truth, then truth is absolute. And you can't really have it both ways. But that's what our culture is doing. That's the kind of thinking that someone like President Obama adopts and, you know, kind of tries to force upon us, you know, that, you know, we have our truth and they have theirs and we should just leave them be. That's just not the case. Truth is true always.
Amen. Well, there was, as we kind of get into this, and probably Tom would be good on this, and maybe Chris, if you want to jump in, but I think it's really remarkable, as you point out in the book, that Pope Francis has repeatedly articulated just war terminology. When he speaks to the UN and he speaks about the Islamic State, he says there must be a military response to the Islamic State, and then Sheikh Mohammed al-Adnani has responded to the Pope and the Vatican diplomats, and you quote him, "O Crusaders, by Allah's permission, this will be your final campaign." So that kind of threat and the challenge of the Pope has also been, I believe you mentioned in your book, articulated by the Russian Church. Now, how does this all fit in with Petrus Romanus, with the Pope's obvious socialistic ideas, and I think liberation theology, as you've pointed out, has really influenced his thinking, but especially this idea of a just war? What's going on here, Tom?
Just a couple of things very quickly on us going up to Mount Graham in Arizona and Chris going to Sedona, Arizona, and me actually going to the four corners of the United States. How that all wound up happening is because when we got to the top of Mount Graham, we went there to talk to the Jesuits to find out why they were talking about aliens. And what I would want your listeners to know is Chris and I, we reject this whole idea of ancient astronauts and aliens that have been visiting the Earth and abducting people. We just think that that's all either in people's heads or it's demonological. So in our books, what we're trying to do is really find out where the Vatican authorities were coming from, and not to take them out of context, not to misquote them, to try to make them look bad, but to try to really kind of get behind their theology. And the alien thing winds itself around, comes full circle, and comes back to this final book, The Final Roman Emperor, and this idea that there is a coming man who is going to lead a world empire, and basically, if you believe the utopian aspects of those predictions, he's going to cure all the ails of the earth, and he's actually going to resist the coming of the Antichrist, which we think is absolutely backward from correct theology. So that's why we went up there. We're trying to just find out where they're coming from. Of course, we were shown the Lucifer device, which is in the large binocular telescope. And if you wonder what they're using the Lucifer device for, you go to another Jesuit, Malachi Martin, who suggested that all of Mount Graham is being used to monitor something that he said is approaching the earth and that will be of the utmost importance in coming years, and that the Vatican is fully aware of it.
We are back with Tom Horn and Chris Putnam. We're talking about their new book, The Final Roman Emperor, and we have had a little run through or a summarization of the previous three books, because all of this is tied together. This is the fourth book in this ongoing series, 4 years of investigation. These gentlemen have shared with you some of the really amazing things that brought them together, some of the spiritual warfare that they've been involved in. Chris was telling us a little bit about the problems, the challenges that he had. Obviously, there is someone, something from another dimension interfering, but they've got through this, and then they were explaining that their worldview is not pantheism. They're not Jesuits. They don't want to be challenged or charged with that. They're very biblical, have a biblical worldview, and I'm glad they made that point. But we are going to pick up now, and I believe we're going to be speaking to Chris about the, I had raised an issue a little bit at the end of the first program about the Pope and the just war theory and the fact that ISIS is spoiling for a military confrontation with Rome. So, Chris, if you would pick up on that.
Well, certainly. In the early days of the Christian church, you know, right after the Apostle Paul had written his epistles and after the resurrection, you know, the church was really trying to define doctrine. So you see all these struggles to define things like the Trinity and, you know, what's the scope of the atonement and all these, you know, fundamental theological issues. But as time went on and Jesus had not returned yet, you know, many of them expected him to return right away, the church started addressing other things because they had to. You know, how are we going to handle war? You know, are we supposed to turn the other cheek? And, you know, what are the qualifications? So you have the early theologians starting, you know, to write about these ideas. Now, you know, one of the first ones and the guy that probably defined it as far as Roman Catholicism was Thomas Aquinas, and he wrote extensively. And in fact, you know, his policies are the basis of the Roman Catholic Church's policies today. They still follow Aquinas. Now, it's not such a bad thing that they've done this. I mean, there are times, obviously, when we have to go to war. We really don't have a choice, it seems like. And, you know, I don't think Jesus meant for us to turn the other cheek and just get beaten down and have our families, you know, raped and robbed and all these things. We're supposed to defend ourselves, I think. I think that's a biblical concept. You know, a lot of people try to label Jesus a pacifist, but I do not believe that Jesus was a pacifist.
Right, I agree.
You know, he's turning over tables and running people out of the temple courtyard. So, you know, he wasn't beyond doing that when it was necessary. So there are times when war is necessary. So I don't want to just criticize the Catholic Church for saying that we should stop ISIS, because I agree, we should stop ISIS. The question really becomes who should stop them and who has the authority to do it, and why is a religious body the one advocating? That's a better question. You don't see, you know, all the other churches coming out declaring that we need to stop ISIS. But, you know, individuals do that. But it's more interesting when you have a large institution, especially when it's led by someone who's supposed to have absolute authority, the vicar of Christ, allegedly, articulating these ideas. So Aquinas took the concept of war, and he developed some qualifications, and I think they're still rather valid. And this is the kind of language that Pope Francis has been using in his interviews. He's using terms like unjust aggressor. These are direct quotes from Aquinas. And then he throws in terms like genocide, which is kind of inflammatory. It's true. I mean, but he's doing that intentionally. It's not an accident. He's trying to invoke these ideas. Now, you know, unjust aggressor, genocide, you know, these kind of lead people to think that war is justifiable, right? And so that's one of the first qualifications for a just war, because it's two groups. The first one is called jus ad bellum. That's just Latin, and it just means the right to go to war. You know, you have some kind of justification. What is that? Well, it's genocide. We've seen what's happened to the Syrian Christians. You know, millions of people are displaced. And, you know, one of the oldest, probably the closest to the apostolic church would probably have been in Syria, around the Damascus area. That's where Paul had his vision of Jesus. That's where he converted. It's not surprising that some of the most oldest rooted Christianity is right in that area, but they're not now. ISIS has destroyed that. And so is there a right to go to war? Certainly. And so that would be the justification. That would be the first qualification. Now, the second one is called jus in bello. Now, that's right conduct within war. Now, this gets more controversial. How do we go about wars? You know, do we hide behind things and shoot people, or do we all line up in straight lines and shoot at each other the way they used to? Now, this is how, you know, we probably won the American Revolution, because we didn't play by the rules. The British all wanted to line up in pretty lines and shoot each other, you know, across the battlefield like targets almost. But the Americans adopted guerrilla warfare and started hiding behind things and jumping out of trees and, you know, surprising them. And this was kind of a new thing at the time. And I think we probably learned it from the Indians. So this is right conduct within war. Who gets to decide that? You know, it's really up to the people in the war, I suppose. But now we have, you know, international laws and all kinds of things of that nature to consider. But, you know, do you kill innocent bystanders? Now, this has been controversial with, you know, using the drones. You know, is this right conduct within war? Is this justifiable that we fly a machine in and indiscriminately blast the place? A lot of people would say that it's not justifiable. So that's been one of the debates. So these are valid questions that they have. But what we're noticing is that when Pope Francis is giving these interviews, he talks about ISIS, he invokes this terminology. He talks about just wars. He talks about the right to go to war. He talks about right conduct within war. One of the things that he's been saying that we are somewhat troubled by is that he's really criticizing the United States. He's saying it's not up to one country to do this. You know, he doesn't want to see the United States do something like we did in Iraq and invade another country. Now, he might be right about that, but, you know, it gets a little bit more troubling when he starts advocating who should do it, and that's what he's doing. He's really pushing the UN, and he's calling for, you know, a UN force from all the countries, and that's what he's advocating. Now, why do I find that disturbing? Well, the UN, of course, has a reputation in our circles of being very New Age itself. In fact, a lot of their spiritual doctrines are adopted from people like Alice Bailey, the Ascension of the Hierarchy, and things of that nature. So it's really tied into this pantheistic, monistic worldview, this oneism that I talk about. The UN is really big on promoting that kind of spirituality. So is Pope Francis. I don't think that's an accident. So I think that the fact that he's kind of promoting the UN the way he is pushing us toward globalism. It's pushing us toward a one-world government. And ISIS, prophetically, I don't really see them as, you know, part of the Antichrist beast system or anything like that. But I see them as a device that's being used perhaps by the powers and principalities, the immortal beings that we don't see, are kind of promoting this and pushing this forward in order to instill fear. Because when the international community has fear, they need an international response. And Pope Francis is doing, hey, let's get the UN to do it. And, you know, before we know it, we have the United Nations Army and a world government. And that's where it all seems to be heading. And I see ISIS as a tool to push us toward globalism.
Let me jump in with an interesting comment, and it's something that you bring up in the book, very early in the book, in fact, on page 40. At the bottom of the page, you raise the question, is the next great awakening right around the corner? And we believe it is. But how does all of that fit in all of this evil with ISIS, with globalism, with liberation theology? And then you explain, well, number one, women will be more involved than they were in any previous great awakening. And then you speak about young people around the world will catch the vision. So maybe, Tom, you could address this issue. You know, this is something close to my heart, and I believe it's close to your heart as well. We're talking about all these ugly, yucky things, and suddenly we're talking about the next great awakening. What's going on?
Yeah, well, and by the way, just so the listeners out there know, Larry, you and I and Donna Howell are working on a project right now called The Next Great Awakening. That's the tentative title. And we'll be putting that out later this year. And basically in that book, what we're saying is that there could be trigger events that cause people to wake up from their slumber. We think there's going to be trigger events with this just war. We think ISIS is going to use a weapon of mass destruction that will cause the Pope to call for the enactment of just war so that you'll have a coalition army, something like the first Iraq war, where pressure will be put on the United Nations and the United States to form a coalition army. And by the way, we go into a lot of prophecy in this final book, The Final Roman Emperor, about how that could play out in a way that the radical Islamists will see it as the fulfillment of their prophecy in the coming of the Mahdi, but the Roman Catholics will see it as the fulfillment of the Final Roman Emperor prophecy and the coming of this temporary savior who will resist the coming of Antichrist. But there are some things that could come out of this terrible tragedy that could occur. Let's imagine that ISIS uses a weapon of mass destruction that causes what happened recently in this attack on the gay bar in Florida to pale by comparison, where now we're talking about a dirty nuke or something like that, and literally hundreds of thousands of people could be affected by it. Enormous pressure would be put on the United States and the United Nations to quit pussyfooting around with this and to literally declare war against the terrorists. That's where the Pope could come in and sanction that. Well, you know that the 1,300-year-old prophecy that the ISIS regime is following, that they ascribe to Muhammad, says that at the end of time they're going to go to war against the armies of Rome. Well, Rome doesn't have an army, but if the Pope were to sanction war using just war theory against these radical terrorists, then they could perceive it as this army fighting under the banner of Rome. And therefore it fulfilled their prophecy, but it would also fulfill other prophecies. But what does that got to do with revival? Well, don't forget that at the end of World War II, when the Holocaust was probably finally put to an end, and we didn't have mass information back then like we do today. There was no internet. It was difficult to get the spread of information. And many in the United States and across Europe for the first time started learning about what was going on in the Holocaust and the death camps, Dachau, Auschwitz, and the rest of it. And when the world saw that, they were horrified. Now, what many today may not even realize is that there had been a Zionist movement, a push for Israel to have its own nation state, even during and before World War II, but it never really got its legs under it until people saw the Holocaust. When they saw these death camps and started learning that millions and millions of Jews had been put together by the Nazi regime, a call went out from around the world, and so now the United Kingdom, Britain, the United States started putting pressure through the United Nations, joined the Zionist movement to declare a nation state for Israel. And of course, now we all know that in 1948, following the Balfour Declaration and other declarations, Israel became a nation again, literally in a single day, and began gathering from around the world to journey back into Jerusalem to create a capital city and to create a nation for Israel. Well, what happened, though, with the evangelical church at that time, which was asleep? I mean, we were really in a slump at that time. Not much of anything was happening. But what happened? When people saw Israel become a nation in a single day, preachers stood up and said, this is the fulfillment of the fig tree prophecy. And Jesus said, when you see the budding of the fig tree, when you see this nation come alive, one generation, it said, that generation will not pass until all has been fulfilled. And this literally gave birth to what today in the evangelical movement we call the age of fire. I mean, people saw the budding of the fig tree. They knew the coming of Christ was imminent. They began preaching, we only have one generation. Whatever we're going to do, we've got to do quickly. It all came out, though, of the sorrows of World War II and the Holocaust, and something triggered, and it woke up the church, and all of the great preachers of the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, everybody from Billy Graham to Oral Roberts to Catherine Kuhlman to all these preachers who were preaching about prophecy, and literally millions and millions of souls around the world were born into the kingdom of God. They gave birth to everything that you and I are experiencing today, the Southwest Radio Church, Skywatch Television. We are still living off of and benefiting from the age of fire that caused the Christian church to wake up. And what we predict, what Tom Horn predicts in the book, The Final Roman Emperor, is that a catastrophic event is coming. ISIS and their cohorts are going to initiate it. It is going to be a weapon of mass destruction. It's going to cause both the Pope, the United Nations, the U.S., European countries, NATO, to rise up, including probably even Russia, to rise up and to officially declare war, to try to stamp out the Islamic nation. They're going to see it as a fulfillment of their prophecy. Rome is going to see it as a fulfillment of the final Roman emperor prophecies. But out of it, I think the evangelical church is going to finally wake up. I think it's, by the way, could even be happening right now. People across the United States especially are very concerned with the imminent loss of their freedoms of speech. Now they're becoming more aware of what's been going on throughout the Middle East for the last few years, with basically a genocide against Christians. And I think all of this stuff working together could, and I predicted in the book, The Final Roman Emperor, give rise to the next great awakening. The church is going to wake up and become preachers of the gospel. Look, I think, like Donald Trump is saying right now, America can be great again. I believe that, but I don't believe that that'll happen as an effort of politicians primarily. I think America will be great again because if my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven, God says, and I will forgive their sins and I will heal their land. I think a spiritual awakening is first and foremost the greatest need that we have today.
Amen. Well, I agree with that. You guys mentioned some amazing things that have been attributed to Pope Francis. For example, the Archbishop of Naples, Cardinal Crescenzio Seppe, credited Pope Francis with transforming the 2,000-year-old blood powder of St. Gennaro back into liquid form and things of that sort. Now, we don't know if that really happened, but the fact that he is being built up in a very, very special way, how does this fit into the Peter the Roman, the last pope scenario, the fact that he's being credited with supernatural powers?
I'll field that one, Larry.
Okay, great.
In Petrus Romanus, our first book, we lay forth the idea. This is before Pope Francis was even elected, for the viewers that don't, listeners that don't know. But yeah, when we wrote that book, it was before he was elected, and Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, was still the Pope. But we theorized that if this Malachi prophecy has anything to it, and this really is the last Pope, we put forth the idea that it's likely he would be the false prophet that we see in biblical prophecy. Now, I didn't just base that on a hypothesis, you know, just kind of stabbing in the dark. I was looking at the language in the book of Revelation. It says that the second beast has horns like a lamb, yet speaks like a dragon. Now, the Bible is pretty good at defining its symbols. And, you know, you can look at other scripture and get some good ideas about what he means by horns like a lamb. Now, what we find is that horns most often symbolize power. You know, ram horns, you know, bull's horns. A horn is a symbol of power, usually. Even, you know, they make a trumpet out of it. You know, it's a really loud, alerting sound. So a horn is generally known as power. So horns like a lamb, what does that mean? Well, a lamb, pretty obviously, is usually Jesus. It's usually a symbol for the Lamb of God, who was our sacrifice, the Passover sacrifice. And, of course, Jesus fulfilled that on the cross. So someone who's like a lamb means he's seen to be like Jesus, or he's believed to be like Jesus. Yet he's very powerful. But it also says he speaks like a dragon. So we have someone who is seen as a powerful Christian leader, yet his real agenda is to undermine Christian doctrine. Now, if we look at the behavior of Pope Francis since he's been in office, he's probably done everything he can to fulfill that idea.
Yeah, I know some Catholics pretty unhappy with him.
They are, and he's really, you know, overthrowing all kinds of doctrinal stances they've had for hundreds of years. I mean, and some of it almost seems silly to me. It's so sophomoric almost. Like, he was asked about, you know, what are you going to do about the homosexual priests? You know, how do you feel about, you know, homosexual priests within the Catholic Church? And Pope Francis, you know, puts up his hands. Who am I to judge? I thought you were supposed to be the vicar of Christ, the head of the whole Christian Church. Yeah, it's like, why is he saying, who am I to judge? I think he's kind of putting forth a false humility or something. He's trying to create a persona, an image that he's this very humble man. He's doing a good job of that. The media is kind of lapping it up. But, you know, I have a feeling that that's a little bit contrived, because it's hard to believe that he really says, who am I to judge? He's the Pope. Hello. He wouldn't have taken the office if he didn't think he was capable of judging it. So, you know, it's hard to believe him sometimes when he says some of these comments. So I think it's more of a ruse, in a sense, a camouflage. And it does seem to me that he has horns like a lamb and speaks like a dragon. And, you know, he's undermining a lot of Catholic doctrine that Catholics are upset about. I'm not necessarily upset about that, because I don't follow Catholic doctrine. Yet, at the same time, he's undermining things like the gospel in a fundamental way. And that's what really speaks like a dragon. When he has Muslim prayer services held at the Vatican, that's a huge, huge problem. Now, you know, anyone that is familiar with Islam is aware that they don't even believe Jesus died. Okay, they think that there was a substitute on the cross. So what is the gospel? The gospel is that Jesus died for our sins, and that he was raised from the dead on the third day, and that he was seen by all these witnesses. That's how Paul defines the gospel in 1 Corinthians chapter 15.
I wanted to quote, since we do have just a minute, St. Francis of Assisi. He says, "Who outwardly profess it, for in those days our Lord Jesus Christ will send them not a true pastor, but a destroyer." And then you were speaking, Tom, about Roman Catholic theologians. You refer to the 17th century German priest, the Venerable Bartholomew Holzhauser, who wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation. You discussed it on page 259. He believes exactly what you guys are saying. So this is coming from even, well, St. Francis of Assisi. We think of him speaking to the butterflies and the birds, but look at what he says. And then this German priest from the 17th century. All of this is phenomenal. Friends, you need a copy of this book, and it's titled The Final Roman Emperor. With us once again, and Tom, as we're doing the third and last interview, summarize the book, the final book for us. And we've been talking about so many things that you've been bringing out, how many Catholic theologians and Catholic blog writers are kind of right in line with what you guys are saying. I think this is phenomenal. So bring us up to snuff in that point.
I will, and I know Chris will also be able to weigh in, because the truth is Chris did most all of the research on this book. He is the theologian. I'm just the big hype guy, right?
Well, you do a good job, too.
I got to have people like Chris behind me, or I don't really have anything qualified to say. But a quick summary. So what is this final book about? Where did we finally wind up? It is the last one in a four-year research, and we really did come full circle from the first book, Petrus Romanus, the final pope is here, to where we kind of wind up back at the beginning again. If people buy these books from Southwest Radio Church, they're going to find out that central to each one of them is also prophecies that are ascribed to what we call the Cumae Sibyl, the oldest of the Sibyls of Apollo, the Tiburtine Sibyl. So these different Sibyls, Sibyls are just basically ancient prophetesses that mostly prophesied for the underworld god Apollo. But these Sibyls are given high places of reverence within Roman Catholicism. If you visit the Sistine Chapel and you look up at the famous paintings by Michelangelo, you'll only see the Old Testament prophets there. You'll see five of these Sibyls, including the Cumae Sibyl, who is considered to be the most powerful of all of the ancient Sibyls. Now, at Rome, you have the Vatican dome facing the obelisk and the prophecies of the Cumae Sibyl inside the Sistine Chapel. Come to the United States, where it's called Little Rome, the dome faces the obelisk, and guess what? On the Great Seal of the United States are the prophecies of the Cumae Sibyl. They both talk about the time when a final emperor, a final monarch, is going to arrive. Now, Catholics that would be listening to this program would be interested to know this. If you go to Google right now and type in the great monarch or the final Roman emperor, you'll find out that this is believed by a lot of Catholic mystics today. Some of them are talking about it on their television shows right now. They're blogging about it. Why? Well, because this last Roman emperor, this monarch of medieval legend, that is part of Catholic eschatology, Catholic end times belief systems, was predicted to appear on earth when there was a final pope, a final, some of them call him an angelic pope, because on the one hand, they say he and the final emperor are going to withstand the Antichrist. But then there's conservative Catholics that say, no, it's great deception, you've got it backward. You're prepping the world for the coming of the real Antichrist, who is going to claim to be Christ, and so this is great deception. But the belief is there, and here are some of the main talking points inside the final book. First of all, the final Roman emperor happens when the final pope arrives. Well, according to Malachi, of the prophecy of the popes, that's now. That's Pope number 112, Pope Francis, who ironically took as his namesake Francis of Assisi, who claimed that the final pope would be a deceiver. Chris and I found that extraordinary, by the way. You could have knocked us over with a feather when he picked Francis of Assisi as his namesake. Secondly, though, this Sibyl saw some very specific things. We think her prophecies are occultic. We think they are demonic, and we think they're filled with deception, but they were given high levels of credence throughout the church age. Even some of the early church fathers quoted these prophecies, and definitely those who were part of Roman Catholicism. But what did she say? She says that in the end of time, democracy would be viewed as a failed system in the world's mind, and there would be a push to return to a global monarchy, a dictatorship with socialist leanings. And so Pope Francis, who takes Francis of Assisi's name as his namesake and is number 112 on the final prophecy of the popes. By the way, Pope Francis, very intelligent. He knows he's the final pope. He is not blind whatsoever to this celebrated prophecy within Catholicism, which all popes and cardinals have been aware of, not only aware of, sometimes following it like a roadmap, only electing popes and naming popes who could be seen as a fulfillment of this prophecy. They hold this prophecy in high esteem, and he's fully aware of that. So taking that namesake is extraordinary. But what is his message? Well, the Sibyl says democracy would be seen as a failed system. There will be a push to return to a dictatorship, socialism, out of some world global system. And so Pope Francis is out there now saying democracy has failed, socialism. Some people are even calling him a Marxist. But past Pope Francis, look at the mindset of the world right now. Over 50% of Americans 30 years and younger all prefer a Bernie Sanders-like socialism right now over a capitalist or even democracy. 30% of all Americans, regardless of age, have lost faith in democracy. And so this prophecy literally seems to be fulfilling right beneath our feet. Furthermore, the Sibyl says this global monarchy, this dictatorship, is going to result in the Sibyl's golden age under the return of Apollo Osiris. That is the prophecy that is on the great seal of the United States of America, from which we make the term Novus Ordo Seclorum. That is an excerpt from her prophecy about the coming of Apollo. Now, why should Christian evangelicals and conservatives care about that? Well, because she says, "Tis thine own Apollo reigns." This is the second coming of Apollo to establish a world system. But in the New Testament, in more than one place, it identifies that very same spirit as the spirit that is going to be incarnate within the Antichrist. Paul says he will be the son of perdition. And that Greek term perdition is apalia, apalion, Apollo. The book of Revelation says that the beast will rise up out of the bottomless pit and enter into perdition, apalia, apalion, Apollo. So the spirit of Apollo that is prophesied on the great seal of the United States is from the same Kume Sibyl who says this is going to be this final global leader. And here's why I think that a lot of the Roman Catholics that espouse these beliefs and that believe in them are setting themselves up for great deception. This is also why many Roman Catholic scholars and theologians, celebrated theologians in the Roman Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages and all the way up until 400 or 500 years ago, said this is deception and it's going to lead to not an angelic pope, but an anti-pope, a false pope who's going to help the Antichrist come to power and is going to make Rome the seat of the Antichrist. Why? Because they believe a coming great socialist dictator is going to work with this angelic pope as a temporary savior to resist the coming of the Antichrist. That's absolutely backward. What theologians believe is an Antichrist is going to come with a false prophet. They're going to deceive the world, and not until after that happens will the second coming of Christ appear. So they've literally taken this prophecy and they've turned it backwards. It's a form of great deception to get people to accept this coming global dictator and his pope or false prophet as their temporary saviors who are going to war with Antichrist, which in our theology is absolutely backwards. Does that make any sense?
It's amazing. And you know, as you're speaking here, I'm looking at some of the stuff that you've written, then I'm turning to the cover of the book. I see the Vatican, and then I notice, and it's always been a matter of great interest, I see this huge obelisk. Now, you know, there's all kinds of symbolism with obelisks, phallic symbols and things of that sort, and this is probably Middle Eastern. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, well, I'll say something about that. I do want to let Chris weigh in here, too. If you notice, on the top of that obelisk is the ISIS flag. But that's not symbolism originating with us. That's symbolism originating with ISIS and their magazine Dabiq from the cover of their magazine where they show that obelisk with their flag on the top of it. Why? And Chris Putnam did unbelievable work in this final book in which he shows that the belief of ISIS is essentially a plagiarism of this older prophecy of the Kume Sibyl. What they did was they took the prophecy of the Kume Sibyl, which the Catholics predict as the final Roman emperor and his angelic pope, and they turned it backwards, and they made it about the coming of their Mahdi, their savior figure, and their Dajjal, the Antichrist, and Isa, Jesus, they say, is going to come down and fight on behalf of the Islamic radicals. So they turned it absolutely backwards. Now, what has this got to do with Pope Francis in the current times? Several things, and I'm going to go. Let me just do this real quickly. I'll let Chris talk. Pope Francis recently gave an interview, chock full of commentary, literally torn from the pages of this Sibyl's prophecy, in which he said, this just a few weeks ago, He said, quote, it is true that the idea of conquest, by the way, that's part of the prophecy of the Qumran Sibyl, is inherent in the soul of Islam. However, it's also possible to interpret the objective in Matthew's gospel, where Jesus sends his disciples to all nations, in terms of the same idea of conquest. So he is comparing what Christians might do in terms of spreading the gospel as being equal to what these Islamic terrorists are doing, where they're killing people if they won't convert. And then he even went further and said that the Muslim migrants in the European countries need to be breeding with the Europeans in order to assure their growing dominance. Well, when people read our book and they read this prophecy of the Qumran Sibyl, that's exactly what she describes. She says the angelic pope and the coming final Roman emperor will work with both within the Mohammedan religions as well as the Christian religions and the Jewish religions to expunge the radicals and to unify them into a common effort that will lead to this golden age. And then, of course, just like, was it last week or week before, Pope Francis embraces the top imam in this historic meeting at the Vatican, and he makes this cryptic announcement where he says, our meeting is the message. And even Catholic mystics were out there saying, our meeting is the message? What message are we sending? And some of the very conservative Roman Catholics believe we've now entered into that period of time where this false pope is going to help give rise to an antichrist who will be this final Roman emperor. They are talking about it. You can Google this stuff right now and see them on their blog post talking about this. But don't forget that it was Father Malachi Martin. He actually wrote a book called The Jesuits, and Chris did a lot of research on that book, where in which he basically said there is a secret war going on between the Jesuit priests and the regular priests, and he said if the Jesuits ever take control of the Vatican, i.e. become the Pope, which just happened for the first time in history, he said the game is lost. And Rome, he said, will become the seat of the New World Order and an instrument of the rise of the Antichrist, reflecting basically what many other Roman Catholic theologians said throughout the Middle Ages.
You know, it's amazing, as I'm reading the book, The Apocalypse of St. Methodius, this idea, and it's a new element, apparently, from what you write here, this new element to Christian eschatology, the rise of a messianic Roman emperor. Wow, that's what you're talking about. What's the significance as far as this present pope and the flow of things in the Roman Catholic Church today?
Well, Larry, yeah, I found that a lot of these beliefs in this final Roman emperor and the Muslim belief in a Mahdi really stem from the same source. Tom was absolutely correct in that the original source material comes from the Sibyl, from the Roman pagan prophetess. Now, what we find is later Christian authors started creating new books. And around the 6th century, we would call it a pseudepigraphal work, meaning that it's falsely attributed. Now, Methodius or Methodius was a church father in the 3rd century, and really well known. His writings were respected. Now, what appears to have happened is an anonymous author in 6th century Syria composed an apocalypse, which is just the Greek word for revelation. And this became a really popular work amongst the Christian population around Damascus and Syria and, you know, the eastern area of the Middle East. It probably stretched eventually all around the world. But, you know, at that time, it was attributed to Methodius, and everyone believed that. So they thought this was a genuine prophetic revelation. But actually, it was based on many different sources, and it probably had more than one author, actually. Now, scholars have gone through and really dissected it and determined that it wasn't written by Methodius or Methodius. It was probably composed by an anonymous or more than one author in the 6th century. Now, why this ties in is that is where the prophecy of the final Roman emperor really became popular. And so Christians around Syria took that Sibyl prophecy seriously and thought, oh, well, there's going to be this great, you know, Christian Roman emperor who's going to Christianize the world, and then Jesus will return. So that became a really popular belief. Now, at the same time, 6th, 7th, 8th century, right in there around Syria, you have the rise of Islam. And, you know, around Damascus, all these Muslim scholars are composing what we call the Hadith, and that's just a word that means the sayings of Muhammad. So much of Islamic eschatology is based on these Hadith readings. Now, these are controversial even with Muslims. There's, you know, many, many, many volumes and collections of the sayings of Muhammad, and some of them are obviously not authentic. And even Muslims will rate the books, and they have kind of like scores of which ones are more authoritative than others. But it's all very vague. You don't know what you can trust and what you can't. It's all really hearsay evidence. None of it's written by Muhammad. He was illiterate. So you have things like, you know, Sheikh, what's his name, said that Muhammad said. You know, so it's all hearsay evidence. It wouldn't even be admissible in a court of law. But I think what happened is, you know, Christians started believing in this final Roman emperor who's going to Christianize the world. At the same time, you have the Muslims going around saying, oh, Christianity has it wrong. This is the new revelation. This is supposed to surpass that. That was their whole, you know, byline. So you have them trying to respond to this idea of this Holy Roman Emperor. So my hypothesis, and it is not just mine, many scholars share this idea, that the Hadith writers weren't really quoting anything Muhammad said. It's more of an apologetic defense against the Christian belief in a Holy Roman Emperor. They turn it into the Mahdi, who's going to turn the world Muslim before Jesus returns. So it's just a direct counterpart, and it's kind of a polemic against the Christian belief. So I don't think Muhammad ever even said anything about a Mahdi. I really believe that this was a creation of the Hadith writers. So you have the Muslims waiting for a worldly leader to turn the world Muslim. You have a lot of Catholics believing and a Catholic leader to turn the world Catholic. And they're both set up for a human leader who's going to take over the world, you know, supposedly to make it better. Now, I think that's a perfect setup for Antichrist, for Roman Catholics and Muslims. You know, right in the middle, you have Protestants going, hey, wait a minute, don't trust this holy, this final Roman emperor guy. Don't trust this world leader because we think he's the Antichrist. And so, you know, you see that setup perfectly within these prophecies, which stem way back to pagan Rome.
And even some of the Catholic, the best Catholic experts throughout the Middle Ages would agree with what Chris just said. They would have parroted exactly what he said. They believed that this was a setup for deception. And a lot of modern Catholics, especially if they don't attend, you know, church very often or if they haven't studied, they might be absolutely surprised by that because they haven't been hearing nothing about it for a couple of hundred years now, that Rome would become the seat of the Antichrist. But that was a common eschatology among high-level Catholic scholars. And I want to give you a few names for people that might be listening that are Roman Catholic that are saying, what? What are you talking about? They can get our book. Chris Putnam has put many Catholic scholars in there that are saying the same thing. But also get the works of Cardinal Henry Manning. These are, you can Google these, and you can download the PDFs of their works and read them for yourself. Cardinal Henry Manning, Bishop Salvador Zola, Frederick William Helle, and numerous others. Now, bring it into modern times, of course, you would also be talking about people like Malachi Martin and so on. But let me give you one, if I've got time here, let me give you one real quick little point of interest here. Abbot Wardine de Otrante, he was a 12th century Catholic writer. Chris quotes him in the book, The Final Roman Emperor. But there was part of what Chris researched that really stood out to me that I thought was interesting, where this abbot is talking about, when is this final Roman emperor going to appear? When is this actually going to happen? And let me just give you this really quick quote here. He says, the great monarch and the great pope will precede Antichrist. The nations will then go to war for 4 years, and a great part of the world will be destroyed. All the sects will vanish. By the way, this point, the sects will vanish, means that in Mohammedan religions, they're going to push out what the Pope and the leaders of Islam are trying to do now, the Muslim faith. They're going to get rid of the radicals. But it also means on the Christian side, we're going to get rid of the radicals. We're going to get those people like Tom Horn and Chris Putnam and people like that that say things they ought not to be saying. We're going to get rid of all the radicals. We're going to create a one world church. We got this meeting, interestingly, going on in Washington, D.C. in just a few weeks from right now, where the Pope is going to stand in front of that obelisk and he's going to greet this gathering. Anyway, so we're going to get rid of everybody. We're going to unify the church. He said that'll happen. I'm going to continue the quote here. He says, the capital of the world will fall. Now, he doesn't say who the capital of the world is. The Pope will go over the sea, carrying the sign of redemption on his forehead, and after the victory of the Pope and the great monarch, peace will reign on earth. Now, here's the part I want you to get this. And this is something for listeners out there to study. He says, the Pope will cross the sea in a year when the Feast of St. George, that's April 23rd, falls on Good Friday, and St. Mark's Feast, that's April 25th, falls on Easter Sunday, and the Feast of St. Anthony, that's June 13th, falls on Pentecost, and the Feast of St. John the Baptist, which is June 24th, falls on Corpus Christi. So he gives a very specific time when this is all going to happen. Well, guess what? The concurrences of those feasts will only take place in 2038 and not before. Now, the War of the Great Monarch is World War IV. That lasts about 4 years. So now we're backing up. These different things that have to happen. The Pope crosses the sea to Europe when the Holy See is in exile. This all happens in 2038. Therefore, the war has to end in 2037, which starts 4 years before that, around 2033, and Europe is occupied during the 2020s. And so, if you examine this in the book that we've written, I'm not saying this, Chris Putnam is not saying this, Wardine de Otrante, 800 years ago, said this, that these Muslim extremists are going to conquer Europe sometime between 2016 to 2017.
Well, gentlemen, we're just about out of time, but Tom and Chris, you guys have done a fantastic job of research and then just explaining it and making it plain and simple for our listeners. I really appreciate the three interviews.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Larry, for having us on. This is the final book in this four-year series. Chris and I may do other work in the future. I wouldn't doubt that we do, but that's the end of 4 years of research, and it's the most extraordinary four-book set. I really want to encourage people to get that four-book set from Southwest Radio Church.
Well, we're making a special offer to our listeners. And Mimi, come to the mic and tell our listeners about that offer.
You can have a copy of this new book, The Final Roman Emperor, for a gift of $20 in the United States and $25 in Canada. To place your order, just call our toll-free number, 1-800-652-1144. And this book, as well as all of our materials, are available on our website at swrc.com. Also available are the other books in this series. The book Exo Vaticana for a gift of $10. The book Petrus Romanus for a gift of $10. And the book On the Path of the Immortals, also for a gift of $10. Better yet, get all four books of this exhaustive four-year investigation for a gift of $40. That number again is 1-800-652-1144. Stay tuned over most of these stations for our Bible in the News article here on the Watchman on the Wall program from Southwest Radio Church.
Strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. I'm a stranger and I'm a pilgrim, 'cause my home is really heaven. I'm just passing through 1 Peter 2:11. Only those who seek to please God can truly comprehend the enemy with which we must contend. Dear greet you. I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. Dearly beloved, I beseech you. I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. Abstain from fleshly lusts.